Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional. I would like to acknowledge the sovereignty of all First Nations peoples across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, today's Let's Talk is being broadcast from the Murray School. We've got the mobile studio, or the OB van, as it's called, outside broadcast van. It's out, set up on site at the Murray School, because today we have a dialogue happening that is being facilitated by Mick Gooder, who is my guest at the moment. Mick Gooder is the Social Justice Commissioner with the Human Rights Commission. Mick, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Tell us your mob, your country.
Gungaloo Country, Woorabinda, Central Queensland. That's my mob, my mum's mob, my grandmother's mob. So my family is all still pretty much in Rockhampton, although as we get the younger generation come on, they spread out, even mob living in overseas now. People over in WA, Brisbane. Hmm. So the young ones move.
Where did you grow up?
Rockhampton, Serena, just south of Mackay.
You go to school? Where did you do your school? High school? What sort of stuff?
In Rockhampton, Christian Brothers College, near the big cathedral. That's where I was actually taught by Christian Brothers back in the day. So there were still a lot of them around. Very few lay teachers. So, yeah, Rockhampton, Christian Brothers. My sisters went to the Range Convent. So, you know, all the Catholics looked after us.
Yeah, all right. You would have done some time as an altar boy then, maybe.
Mate, I was an altar boy, swinging the incense around.
Yeah.
Dressed up in that weird clothes.
Yes, and speaking Latin.
I also,
in Theodore, went to the convent school in primary, but was an altar boy, speaking Latin.
Absolutely. Weird, isn't it?
But, yeah, that's the first time I acknowledge that publicly on air. I generally don't. I keep that to myself, that I'm an altar boy, that I was an altar boy.
you look at all the stuff coming out of the Child Abuse Royal Commission, and I guess we were the lucky one. It was a day school anyway. It wasn't a boarding school, which would have made a bit of difference. So the only thing happened to us, we got belted fairly often with the strap. So
I had none
of that other business.
Yes, I had the nuns in the convent school, and they were quite vicious.
Yeah, I was taught by nuns in my primary school. Mm. They had the cane.
Mm, they had the cane, and didn't they like to use it?
Belted me a few times.
Oh, yeah, I copped it. I was a class clown, of course. Yeah, I looked for it a lot of times.
And scary, you know, like, because back in those days, the nuns still had the big black habits, there was for a little kid, 5 years old, going up there, it was fairly scary to go and confront some of those old ladies, you know.
For sure, for sure. Mick, you're facilitating community dialogues across the country regarding the United Nations Declaration for the Rights of Indigenous People. Yep. What's the purpose? Well, what's the intent here? Because the UN Charter, this particular charter, has been out, was signed off by all that was required to sign off, Canada, New Zealand, the UK, Australia.
140 countries signed off on it back in 2007. But at that stage, those countries you mentioned, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the USA, they actually voted against it. We changed our opinion when Labor got in. In 2009, we told the UN we now endorse the declaration, and the others followed fairly soon after that. So now we have this document that's in the United Nations that no nation in the world opposes. So it's a very strong document with support of just about every nation on Earth, really. So our job is to actually take it and make it practical to people. There's a lot of things in it. There's 46 articles. There's about 22 paragraphs in the preamble. It's written in fairly dense language from the United Nations. our job is to actually interpret it down for mob to see how they can use it in their everyday lives, in their work lives, if they're advocates, how you can use it to advocate the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander position. So our job is really make people aware of it and give them some tools to use it.
All right. You've already engaged with a number of communities. What are some of those communities you've been to? You've been to some
Cairns,
of
we've been to Coffs Harbour last week. We go to Port Augusta and Adelaide next week. We've done some in Innisfail and the Atherton Tablelands. All over. We're trying to cover as many places. We started in Perth with the Noongar people. So we're getting a fair bit of coverage. Mm. And the general consensus is people come away with a whole lot of knowledge they didn't have when they started the day. So that's really pleasing for people to be able to say that, you know, that here's how we can actually advance our rights using the Declaration. So that's the whole purpose of this. And Tiger, these dialogues don't only go with the community. We're doing next month, we start one with business, the business sector, about how they can use how human rights affect businesses and how they can use human rights to engage with a human rights based approach to engage with Aboriginal communities. So, and of course, government. We've been working with government for about the whole time I've been in this position, advocating for the Declaration.
How do you identify businesses to invite for the dialogue?
Oh, there's KPMG in Australia run what they call the Global Compact, which is businesses coming together under a United Nations banner to talk about human rights. So that's, we've engaged with them. We'll probably have 20, 25 businesses, fairly big businesses involved in our dialogue later in July. Again, just getting them to understand human rights, because businesses are a bit different to governments. You know, we've actually got to make the business case why a human rights-based approach can work. And our argument is generally, not just around Indigenous issues, if you follow a human rights-based approach, it can actually save you a lot of money. So you take native title, you know, we talk about in the Declaration the right to participate in decisions that affect you, self-determination. There's a whole lot of things around land. And we say if you take a human rights-based approach of engaging with people right up front, say in a mining deal, you save money. They think, let's see, a lot of businesses think they'll save money by not engaging with us, you know, or just tack it on the end of a long process, when in fact I tell them all the time, you know, we want to work with people, but if you don't want to work with us, we're not bad at fighting neither. And we can tie, you know, companies have been tied up in court for years, so it ends up costing them a whole lot more money to try to beat us up. So we make those sort of cases with business.
Making those sort of cases with government would be a bit different, wouldn't it? I mean, to talking to government about a human rights-based approach. I mean, for example, Northern Territory intervention legislation, that sort of stuff.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we'll talk about that today, how they suspended the Racial Discrimination Act, absolutely abused the rights of 73 communities. And they did that to do the nasty things they want to do, like income management, taking land, all that sort of stuff. And they wouldn't have been able to do it had the Racial Discrimination Act been in place. They just suspended it. Causes Australia lots of grief overseas, but more grief for our people in those 73 communities. You know, and I think I talk about how we all feel, you know, a comradeship with all of our mob across the country. So not only did it affect people in the Northern Territory, it affected mob here. You know, people were telling me about, it was a throwback to the old days when everyone managed your money, you know, the government managed your money. So it's a different thing with governments as opposed to business, because government's actually the ones that sign these treaties and conventions and the Declaration, and they have a duty to uphold them. So that's our job, is to actually keep governments accountable to the things they sign up to.
So there's the question that has to be asked then is, governments, to be kept accountable, governments have the responsibility, have an obligation. But we've seen time and time again reports from the UN saying that Australia is quite racist. The legislation, the Northern Territory intervention legislation as it was then, now it's stronger futures, I think it is.
Yeah.
Isn't a good human rights-based approach. They've been quite critical in the UN, reports of Australia. But Australia appears to just thumb its nose and continue on its merry way, the government, the federal government.
Oh, yeah, but when you get to do the stuff overseas, and in this job I've started doing that, you learn how Australia really values its international reputation. And that's our job when we do go overseas. Our job is actually present our side. So if government gets up and makes a statement, we can actually present. Like next month, I go to Geneva for the expert mechanism on the rights of Indigenous people. We're there for a week. We'll talk to government about the things we'll be saying in to the forum. There'll be people, there'll probably be about a dozen of us over there, so people like the Native Title Mob, the New South Wales Land Council will probably be there, the women's group will probably be there, and we'll start making what they call interventions, statements on the floor about what's happening in Australia. So, and for mob out there who think it doesn't make any difference, I think it does. I think... like Australia next year will go through what we call the Universal Periodic Review, and that's where Australia gets tested for its human rights record. I went to the first one Australia went through about 4 years ago, and 53 countries spoke and questioned Australia, and they get 3 minutes to speak, and they're very strict on that 3 minutes. Out of the 54 countries that spoke, 50 of them mentioned Indigenous stuff. So the countries are actually keeping Australia accountable. Indigenous people don't get a right to speak at that forum, but we briefed all the other embassies and countries, and a lot of them just said exactly what we wanted to do, things about the Northern Territory intervention, about engagement, about following the declaration, those sort of things. So... I like to reassure people when we don't think we got any traction here in Australia, people overseas keep Australia accountable in the forum. So that was pretty heartening to see 50 of those countries raise Indigenous issues with Australia.
Mm. Yes, no, it is important that we're represented and that we have a voice at these forums. That's important. And like you say, you can lobby other countries.
Yeah,
to be able to be supportive and help keep this government accountable.
Yeah, and that's pretty important because, again, Australia likes to big note itself on the international stage and think they do all this stuff. So, it's, the embassies. It's funny, and funny thing is when you go overseas, the most assistance we get is from the Australian embassies. It's better than most government departments here in Australia, isn't they? And they'll say to us, well, our job is to put Australia in the best light. We know your job is to actually raise the issues affecting Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And we all get on. It's not like... I've worked with government and then you do that sort of stuff in Australia. They don't talk to you for 3 months. Mm. You sort of get blackballed for a while. But overseas, it's a bit different, and the embassies really support us,
Very good.
So we're allowed to... funny thing is we're allowed to question Australia and not overseas, but when we do it back here in Australia, they're talking about, stopping people speaking out about government here in Australia with grants, putting conditions on grants and all that sort of stuff, like Howard did back in the day.
Mm, yeah, for sure. What are some of the key elements within the Charter for the Rights of Indigenous People? What are some of the key elements in there that you sort of impress upon our mobbing communities when you have these dialogues? Are there a couple of key elements that people need to sort of take note of and maybe start to live and enact?
Well, there's 46 articles. Like I say, they're pretty dense to read. What we've done is in the Human Rights Commission with Congress have developed four principles: self-determination, the right to participate in decisions that affect you, non-discrimination, and respect for and protection of culture. Now, if you use those principles and apply them to all the articles, you're going to get pretty close to what you want. So that's what we talk about. Like, we went to one town and there was a one mob in dispute with the land council. Then the land council come along to the dialogue as well. And we said, look, we're not here to resolve this problem, but what we're going to do is give you some tools to use to work through it. And that's what they did. They eventually sorted it all out. You know, things like, you can't exclude us because we have a right to participate. This decision this thing you're doing affects us. So the basic tenet in I think Article 18, you know, the right to participate in decisions. That's a human right. That's not just a right for Indigenous people, but that's a human right that we have. So it's incumbent upon the people to make sure the people who are affected by community by decisions to actually participate in those decisions. And that's whether it's government, a business, or some of our own Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander organisations. It actually guides the relationship. So if people use those four principles, you're going to be okay. You're going to get through it, I reckon.
One of the big issues or big issues that we have to deal with is that hand-picking who you talk to, Muckaty Station, for example. Somebody in that area, traditional owners, have said, yes, it's all right, to the land council. Land council's gone into the government and said, yes, we're right for a waste dump out here. And then the other mob have come together and said, hang on, this is not right. Yeah. So they've now got a case in court questioning that. We need to be on top of things in our own way, in our own community, to try and reduce the effects or the opportunity for this fragmentation and different views to people to be handled. Because you say consultation, then I go out for consultation and you've got to consult. And the government can say, well, yeah, we consulted. We got the land council that said Muckaty Station's fine because they've reported on behalf of one or two traditional owners, whereas there's a group of traditional owners that are saying it's not right.
Well, what I'd say to people in that situation is, you know, if there's a dispute about who the right people are, have the right people been consulted and involved in the decision? If there's some doubt on that, the first thing I'd say, put everything on hold. And the Land Council has a duty. It's not just governments that have duties here. The Land Council has a duty to go and engage with the people who are affected by this decision, not just a hand-picked bunch of people who are probably going to agree with what they're proposing. So, and that's the whole basis of self-determination. Self-determination only works when everyone's heard. Not just a few in the community, not just a select few, not just a strong, when the most vulnerable, like women, children, old people, they've got to be heard. If that's not happening, it's not self-determination. It's just a few people who happen to be strong and the loudest making noise get heard. So the duty upon government is, you know, to make sure. See, my job is not really to make a decision or come on one side or the other with Muckaty Station and the toxic, you know, the waste dump. My job is to make sure everyone's heard. That's what I advocate. It's their business. See, I don't live there. I'm not affected by that decision like those people are. So I don't have a voice, really. My voice is to make sure other people are heard. That's how it works with me. So it's pretty incumbent upon, you know, our organisations, business and government to make sure people are involved. And not just, we've written some guidelines about consultation, how it should work. We use consultation in the international context, and that really means negotiation. But like you say, some governments and people in this country say, oh, I went and spoke to someone, I'll just go and do whatever I like. But it should be conducted in the way negotiations are. That's the international interpretation of consultation.
For sure. Where to after the dialogues, the round of community dialogues, where to from there? Is there any monitoring or any maintaining of contact where people can call in and talk?
Well, we're setting up a hotline, so when people get confronted by issues. Like mob rang me, they ring us fairly regularly saying, look, I've got this issue, what should we use? And we'll sit down and work our way through which article they should look at, what are those principles they should be using. another principle under the right to participate is free, prior and informed consent. Of people making an informed decisions, and again, using Muckaty Station as an example, do they people understand what's going to happen when this stuff goes on their land, and the risks that they're going to run by taking that nuclear waste? I'd be arguing that they've got to, were you aware of this? And if they're not aware of it, you don't really count it as a proper decision. We have a my view on this is it's a duty of the people seeking consent to make sure the people giving consent are informed. So I remember this land case, one mob rang up and they'd signed an agreement with the government and the government wanted to change it. And they rang me and I said, well, if I were you, I'd be saying, we need some money to go and get a lawyer to advise us on the changes. And this government said, no, we're not giving you any money. And the mob said, well, that's okay, we don't want to change it. You're the one that wanted to change it, so we're not even going to talk about it until we can make fully informed decisions. And finally, the government had to come to the party and give them about $30,000-$40,000 to go and get a lawyer to brief. So, and they argued that from the declaration, we have a right to make informed decisions, and we're okay with this. We've signed the agreement. You're the one that wants to change it. You're the one that's got to inform us, make sure we're informed about how the changes affect us. So there's we're getting that sort of stuff happening now where people can go and argue really practically about the declaration and how it affects them. And in this particular case, it was a win. You know, the government ended up the mob ended up agreeing to the changes the government wanted. But
had to go through the process.
Had to go through the process. Had to make an informed decision. So you use those sort of things, and I think what we try to do is be really give them really practical ways of using it, not just a high level esoteric discussion around rights, rather, but how to use them.
Mm-hmm. All right, that's probably about it for the discussion on.
I've got to go upstairs and start now.
Got to go and do other things.
Yeah. Got to go and talk to mob.
Get it happening.
Yeah.
Mick, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
And thanks, mate. And thanks for your support over the years. You know, it's way of getting messages out to mob and all that. So you've been really important in part of that, making sure people are informed.
Can't say no to countrymen.
Can't. No.
Another Kungaloo man. Yes. Now, Mick Gooder joining me today at the moment. He's off now to do the official business of opening up the community dialogue regarding the United Nations Declaration for the Rights of Indigenous People, where there is a series of community consultations taking place across the country to have our mob better informed and in a position where they can, where they're more able to live and act out the self-determination that is the end result of the, one of the key focuses of the declaration. My next guest, we're broadcasting, by the way, Let's Talk is coming to you from the Murray School out of Acacia Ridge. This school is, what is it? Yeah, 30 years old. Yeah, I think 2015, turns 30. This school is one of a kind. It is proper community-controlled organisation. They own the title to this school. It runs from P to 12. And it's, again, one of a kind. The community owns this school. And there's not that many schools. I think it's the only one in Queensland where the community actually owns it. It's not the Christian money and other different situations. They don't determine how the schools run. In this case, it's community business. That's the Murray School, the Aboriginal and Islander school. My next guest joining me is Michael Curry. Michael has been working in child protection for some time and is now a reform project officer with Child Protection Peak. Michael, welcome to the program. How are you, bud?
Thanks, Tiger. Yeah, good, brother. Okay.
Tell us your mob, your country.
My mob's Manindali, Yugambeh, from the southeast Queensland. On my grandmother's side, she's Manindali, with links to Gugujin and Yagara. So, yeah, Brisbane born and bred.
All right. So you grew up in Brisbane?
Yeah, yeah.
Went to school here?
Yes. Over on the north side, our mob were one of the first families post-war to move into the commission houses over and over on Chermside. Been around for a while.
Has there always been a... There's always been a presence of our mob in the north side, but I think it's been a bigger presence on the south side. Correct me if I'm wrong. In the time when you grew up and we even went through high school and stuff like that.
Definitely. Certainly the stories that my father and grandmother and talk about being, the one of the only Aboriginal families on the north side and Chermside, and I think a lot of the mob were on the south side because I think, mainly because, they used to have the old barracks out at Wake Hole, and there were large communities and out at Inala. And but for some reason, I think the north seemed to be like the Wild West. But having said that, there used to be mobs used to hang around. My grandmother told me mobs used to hang around down at Boondall in the swamps and play cards down there back in the old days.
All right. Interesting. Now, child protection. You've been involved out in the territory. Worked out there for a while in this field.
Yeah. Not so much in the territory. I was doing youth justice in the territory for the last 18 months. But prior to that, I was doing remote child protection in Western Australia. Up in Bardi country, so just north of Broome. So I was there for 5 years working across five communities as a community child protection worker. Basically, my role there was just working with the mob to negotiate the child protection system and try and achieve better outcomes for our children and our families.
So there's a direct link then between this business that's happening, this dialogue that Mick Gooder is facilitating.
Yes.
There's a direct link there and within the child protection framework for our mob to understand rights and responsibilities within the child protection framework.
Yes.
So that we can best argue our position and keep that government department in check, I suppose, because there's far too many of our kids still being taken.
Look, that's right, and we know we're vastly overrepresented, and the challenges for our families and for our communities in negotiating the child protection system is about rights based and them knowing their rights and of course, as we know, with rights come responsibilities So it's about, it's about self-determination. It's about, providing the information and working with our mob so that they can make informed decisions about about what decisions are made and how that's going to affect them. And more importantly, about what they can do to be able to improve the lives of their kids and the family and strengthen the family. And we've got, as you know, a number of services across a variety of areas that work with our families and do that really well.
Are there similarities or are there different issues? I suppose the answer is yes to both questions. But you tell me, you've been in remote communities in the West. Much difference in what they're dealing with in regards to child protection and stuff like that? Some common themes, I suppose, some common issues.
Yes, and so, we all know some of the common themes around.
Yeah, there's common thieves, too. There is common thieves. It's a nice tip of the tongue, Michael.
some common themes, and of course poverty and disadvantage is there. It's really about, I think for regional and remote areas, some of the big challenges for them is if you're a family and you're in crisis, You know, so if you have got an alcohol or a drug problem and you are genuinely seeking help, and your children are involved in the child protection system because of the direct links, because of your alcohol or drug problem, you know, you are required to address that. And I think in remote and regional services, that's quite hard to do. If you're an alcoholic, for example, it requires a dedication and strength and support.
Resources and facilities.
That's right. That's right. And when you've got a lot of services, there are fly-in, fly-out specialist services. You know, so if you want to see a drug and alcohol person, they're going to come in every 4 to 5 weeks, and they're going to sit down with you for an hour. You know, so, and on the other hand, I guess from an urban setting, you know, we're lucky enough to have Aboriginal medical services and drug and alcohol, and it's quite, it's a lot easier to access those services. So there is a bit of a difference there, yes, but it all comes down to, each person being motivated to want to make those changes, and when you have those supports, I think it's just more encouraging that you've got that support there. The more support, obviously, that you have, the more successful your chances are, you're going to be a lot likely to succeed.
Are there enough of our own mob, First Nations mob, working in various capacities within this field for the government?
We've got, I think all government departments, both state and federally, will say that they need to increase the amount of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island staff within government. I think they all know, given the representation of the clientele is usually, it can be quite high. So, can be up to, for child protection, we're around 38%. So, there's a natural, you would think that would be reflected in the staffing ratios of the services that are provided. But in terms of practitioners, so when we talk about practitioners, social workers and psychologists, etc., there is a great need for those. We are seeing a lot of young ones coming through and pursuing that. Certainly, I've been doing this for about 17 odd years, and there are certainly a lot more young Aboriginal professionals in the field than when I first started. But we need more, definitely. Mm. Yeah.
In dealing with our children, our young ones, yeah, we're needing in our own community safe houses or families that are deemed to be acceptable by the government to be able to take care, to be carers and stuff like that.
Yep.
The first question is, the government, I think, is supposed to have a policy that first option or first choice should be any children to be removed from families should be placed in the community, either with extended family but with their own mob in the community.
Yes. Yep.
How's that going?
So, I think what you're getting at there is the Aboriginal child placement principles, we had the Carmody inquiry, and there was a number of recommendations about what the system can do to improve that. Part of what we're doing, at QuadSIP is working with our membership to improve areas of service, and certainly, foster and kinship care is one of those that need to improve. The short answer is that we need more, we have to work with our families and communities to improve that. So we both need, we need more foster and kinship carers. It's because the demand for our young people in, for say out of home carers is way way out of control.
So that's still a real concern, the fact far too many of our mob are getting sort of just taken. I mean, they're taken on various grounds. Like you say, it could be alcoholic parents or could be just deemed neglect. Mm. And neglect can have a very broad sort of, can be a broad brush painted there with neglect, whereas a First Nations family or community might disagree with the term neglect that's been placed on a particular family. Mm. And that's, tell us about the Child Protection Peak. What's its role?
So the peak is you know, the two primary areas for the peak that we're focusing on at the moment, and that is around sector development. So working with our members to build their capacity to be able to engage and work with families. And build the capacity of the organisations and strengthen them and support them. And the other part is around practice. And so it's about supporting and working with our members to think about the way of working. So we're currently part of what I'm doing as a reform project work is working with our members to establish a framework. And we'll establish a framework of practice, and which all our members will agree, and then out of that we'll have a set of standards. And so that framework will reflect how we work and how we want to work. So we're talking about things about around the framework and standards is about cultural competencies. How do you demonstrate as an organisation that you're culturally competent to be able to work with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families? It's about, you know, the rights of the child. It's about working with the UN Charter of Rights and the Aboriginal Child Placement Principle, and really supporting our organisations to be able to strengthen the way and really be sure about what they do, why they do it, and how they do it when it comes to child protection space for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children and families. So. Yeah.
Big job there.
It's massive. Mm. It is huge. Look, when the good thing, what I'll say,
because you can be seen as meat in the sandwich too.
Oh yeah. What I will say is that we've got some organisations out there who do some really good stuff, and I think that there's an opportunity for them now to be able to. Showcase some of the ways that they work. So I'm very optimistic that given from where we come from, and where we're at, I think from here we can only improve. So I'm optimistic about that, and I think everybody has got some goodwill around that, and I'd say including our government. Mm-hmm. To make a change, and I think we've got better times ahead, but it is a big job, yes.
And it's not just First Nations families that are feeling the brunt or the impact of decisions made by government officials. Mainstream families haven't been catered to all that well. The children, they're being removed from, it's questionable, and they've been removed from one environment to another that some of our mob will say, well, that's worse off, they know better. Well, and in the mainstream community, a similar sort of a problem, I think, that the way that children are moved around and placed and misplaced, that I don't think the government's got a good track record even on the white side of town. Would that be fair to say?
That's the problem, I think, with a systemic approach to an endemic problem, and I think what is unique about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, First Nations people, is that we're very resilient and we're very resourceful, we've got an opportunity to demonstrate to others, including our non-Indigenous services and supports, that we work in a way, and I like to call that way a third space in between the government and community. And we have a way of working, and I think there's an opportunity for us to showcase some of that stuff. Right. So.
The Carmody Inquiry, was there anything in there that got you excited? The recommendations, same old, How do you see it?
Look, what's really exciting about the comedy broadly is that I think it's put the focus on over-representation and it has asked the question of government about, you know, how are you doing what you're doing, because clearly it's not working. Mm. It's not.
When you say over-representation, what are we talking about? 40% of...
About 38.
Close to 40%.
Yeah, 38. And it's been increasing.
And that's the percentage of our people, First Nation kids,
involved in the child protection system. Involved in the child protection system. Mm. Yeah. I think one of the good things about it is it's highlighted. And put a spotlight on that.
Okay, on the over-representation.
That's right. And there's been... there is a concerted effort to address that. So I think that's, without going into... all the minutiae about what potentially come out broadly, I think putting that spotlight on the over-representation and asking... asking the community and asking government about, what it is that we can do differently. What do we think that we can do differently? So,
all right, Michael. Anything else you want to add?
Oh, no, thank you for
You've
the
been
opportunity.
Talking enough, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for coming in. It's good to have you here.
Thanks, Tiger. Yeah.
Cheers. You have a good day.
Cheers,
Michael Curry, joining me from Child Protection Peak. He's a reform project officer. Not a reformed project officer, but he's working in that area of reform. That's Michael Curry. My next guest is Jodie Curry, joining me live in the studio. Jodie Curry works with the Institute for Urban Indigenous Health. Jodie, welcome to the program. How are you?
Very well, thank you, Tiger. Thank you.
Tell us your mob, your country.
I'm a Mananjali woman. I'm a Yukunbeer woman. My country goes from the Logan to Tweed River and out to McPherson Ranges. I'm born and bred in Brisbane. I'm a Brisbane black. I'm very proud to be an urban Aborigine as well.
Very good. Very good. You sound like a happy blackie.
I am a happy blackie. I certainly am a happy blackie. Darkie even.
Well, no, we won't go that far to darkie, but a happy Murray. We'll be happy all round.
And I guess, around that, it's about indigeneity, isn't it,
It is.
And the different things of how that we represent or how that what... the words that we hear or whichever in our old people and how they use those words or not use those words.
And how they change along the way. Because these days we're hearing more of First Nations as opposed to Aborigine, Darkie.
Yep. Goori.
But we could be, I think we could be, more specific and better terms are a Mananjali woman.
Yes.
You, for example.
Yep.
Saying I'm a Wiri man or I'm a Waka Waka, whatever. Yes, but things change along the way. We get a little smarter in the way we do things. But look, tell us about the relevance, the importance of these sorts of dialogues, but the link back, self-determination and health.
Mm-hmm. So when the thing about the declaration, and I think also about having it at the Murray School, we wanted it so that kids could participate, because I think, we talk about all of the different... human rights or self-determination or empowerment and all of these different things, but it's really actually being able to understand where that comes from, and it's not just within an Australian context, that we actually are a part of this, global village and this global Indigenous people, across the whole country, across the whole globe. It's about our core connection to country and who that we are as Indigenous people, and being able to then articulate that in a legal framework, but actually be able to, as Indigenous people, and as I said, I've been having this thinking all the time around indigeneity and how we as colonised people need to rethink how that we are doing what we're doing, and what, and self-determination isn't something that belongs to politicians or Aboriginal activists or non-Indigenous activists, or, it belongs to you as an individual. And I guess for us, within a health framework, and we say at the Institute within Southeast Queensland, and we're getting there, Western medicine alone won't make us well. It's really important, given the process of colonisation, but also, the Western society that we live in around our diet, around our exercise, around, and that's, I think, for all Australians as well. So many people have diabetes and heart disease and other things, but how you actually work with the individual for them to understand what they can do to improve their life within a, you know, as within the Western medicine way, but then also within our interconnectedness with each other and with country and with culture and practice, and that our culture is ever evolving. I think from the declaration, and that's with having it with the kids here, you know, in Brisbane on Bow Desert Road, that it's not just what you see on the TV. It's how you dance. It's how you sing. It's how you talk. It's how you sit and do your homework at night. It's how you interact with your cousins, or how you interact with your non, you know, your Samoan friend or your white friend or your whatever that they are, their background is, that that you within yourself feel that you can have the confidence to be an Aboriginal person and know what that is, and nobody else defines that to you, because that's self-determining. You grow into your own skin and be your own person. So I'm really pleased and excited that it's here at the Murray School, and that we can be a part of it. They said to us, Mick Mobb said, you know, it's the one of the biggest ones that they've had in the whole of the country. So, and, you know, and we just did that through word of mouth, and it wasn't any, you know, big sort of a thing as such. We did put an ad on the radio, it's just that thing of empowering people as individuals, and it will grow from then. From there, you know, what this global thing of United Nations Declaration of Indigenous Peoples is. So, yeah.
Do you think we're changing somewhat, or from your own observations, in that within the health framework, and we as community members, as First Nations people, are we changing somewhat in the way we view things? You said earlier we will not get well solely with Western medicine.
Mm.
Do you think a lot of our mob, are they seeing that? Is that something new to them? How do you feel? Because a lot of us feel so disempowered and so controlled by the doctor, the GP that says, take this, take that, and we don't even understand a lot of times.
Yeah. I think it's that it is about making the individual strong enough and being respectful of the individual's right to self-determine, how that they want to deal with their health issues, how that they want to deal with their family, and even about the child protection stuff you're saying before about neglect, you know, what... Neglect can look in so many different ways, versus, you know, what one person might see is that as long as a child has love, security and boundaries, you know, how tidy their house is, or how people speak, you know, talk to them,
or
whether they drink grog, that's right, even take drugs even for that matter, as long as a child is looked after and feels loved and secured and boundaries, and, you know, it's that's what's most important, I think. And how do you actually then empower individuals to know that that's okay to say, no, to say that's not right for me? This is what I need to do.
Yeah.
This is where I need to go. This is what, and be respectful of that. And the United Nations Declaration for us as Indigenous people, I think. A fundamental thing for me personally, it's just that's my thing I get from it, is it's my right as an individual to always have connection and know my connection to country and know my connection to culture and define that how my family define that. And so I think with the doctor's stuff, we try within our space of what we're doing with our Aboriginal medical services to have it so that the client feels that they can make those decisions and do those things and be respectful of that. And look, and Tiger, it's not easy, you know, and not no disrespect to any medical practitioner, but they're trained in their thing and they've worked hard to in their expertise, and it's important and stuff, but they also have to be respectful of others and what that they want to do with, it's up to them.
Community-controlled organisations and self-determination.
Yeah.
I think these organisations, community-controlled organisations, are shining examples of self-determination and the success, the success of these organisations. We're celebrating more than 40 years now, in various parts of the country, for health services and what have you.
Mm.
How do you feel about the community-controlled organisations? Is something government sort of thinks mainstreaming is the way? We needn't have our own services and stuff. But there is some real achievements and real successes with community-controlled organisations, providing they're focused and carrying, taking the community with them.
Hmm. Yeah, and we've had that success in Southeast Queensland. And I did want to say to your listeners, Tiger, particularly in Southeast Queensland, the Institute has Deadly Choices. One of the things that we saw was how important and how useful and practical the tool of a radio is for all people, and but for our mob certainly 98.9. So they did a an evaluation of deadly choices, and most people were how they knew 40-something percent, and I can get you the exact figure. It's definitely over 40%. I didn't think it was closer to 50, but over 40% heard of deadly choices because of the radio. And it was for us that thing about how do we get the message out as far and wide as we can for mob to, you know, start to look after their physical health, in the, and that's what our Aboriginal medical services are there to do. I think the thing about what we've, in southeast Queensland, we've gone from 5 clinics to now 14 clinics. Hi, Browns Plains. Everybody go out to Browns Plains. That was our new clinic, open on the 7th of April. We've got another 2 clinics coming, one out at Goodna. And the mob at Goodna, you know, I'm so pleased. Goodna was like Deception Bay. It's been one of those communities. It's a pocket, you know, fairly isolated within a city. And so we're really happy Goodna's coming online, and so too will Coolangatta. And so we'll have 16 clinics, and that's that thing of mob being engaged in it and us working really hard for it. And coming from the principle of empowering the individual to take control of their life and what it is that they're doing, and not judging them however then they choose to go once they step out our clinic door.
And these decisions to expand into places like Goodna and Coolangatta, I think you said, that's come from because there's a demand out there. We've got mob out there in the community that need access to these services.
Absolutely.
We're probably going to wind up and
lovely
stop the program and join the mob upstairs with the dialogue, the workshop that's taken place. Jody, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Tiger. Really appreciate thank you, everyone. Time. Have a good weekend.
Yes, have a good weekend.
I will. See you then.
All right. Jody Curry, Institute for Urban Indigenous Health, joining me here today. Thank you to Michael Curry also and Mick Gooder. Join us Monday for Let's Talk on your local First Nations station. Have a great weekend.